Thank you for coming in. This is the Enhance Your Messaging and Communication Solutions with Office 365, codenamed the Exchange and Link Online discussion. So we're going to talk a lot about Exchange and Link and how these messaging tools and communication aspects fit into Office 365. So hopefully that's why you're here. And if you have any questions around those, we can always keep it a little more interactive because it's not 600 folks. So we're going to go into Exchange, and from a general agenda, when I look at the 52 slides that I have or so, I want to put it into a little bit of context. It talks about the end user experience, so what it's like for an end user to be communicating through new Office, Exchange Online, Link Online, the new capabilities of the clients across devices. But then we'll go a little deeper. It is a 200-level IT pro session. So we'll go deeper into the security, compliance, DLP. What does it mean if you have all of these devices out in the field and all of these people communicating together? How do you help control, administer, and really drive security around those with some of the features of Exchange Online and also Link Online? And then we'll talk a lot about, from a data perspective, archiving e-discovery, with just a little bit about the eDiscovery Center, which is really based on SharePoint, but how Exchange and Link data flows into there so that you can have in-place hold, you can have archiving, you can have massive mailboxes without having to worry about the release of that data if you have the proper security measures in place. So that's kind of the roadmap for the session. You know, in the keynote and in a lot of the sessions that we've seen with Oslo and all these new ways to communicate, and working like a network. Those are all amazing features coming at some point in time. Everything we're going to talk about today is right now. So I literally went down to our expo, took one of our surfaces off of the expo floor that is connected to Office 365, and that's what I'll demo from. This is all just currently running in production. So if you were looking at sneak peeks or something of the future, we're going to talk about the here today. And that's the beauty of the service. A laptop or a Surface right from our booth, and we're good to go. So we will start with a little bit of the Exchange kind of history and where we come from Exchange perspective. It's really the first multi-tenant cloud service from Microsoft. We saw this years and years ago as we, before even BPOS. Anyone here know the word BPOS? Some of us, perfect. Before BPOS, it was Exchange Labs and EDU and a lot of things that were happening from a Hotmail and how do we build this service out to now we're going to do it on Exchange and now it's a hosted Exchange, and they were a couple years ahead actually before BPOS already hosting Exchange in the cloud. So you see just from a little bit of a timeline, email on the browser, what did we do from a browser perspective? And when you think of Outlook Web Access, and even the earliest modes of Outlook Web Access, was like the first time people even saw AJAX. I mean, it was like Web 2.0 before Web 2.0 was Web 2.0. We did a ton of development on the web side of Exchange and front-ending that so that people could have experiences all across their devices, even quite a long time ago. Email on the phone, which is a big one. Just a little personal story. I live in Seattle. I grew up in Seattle. A friend of mine one day who had gotten a job at Microsoft, he was about a year and a half into his career at Microsoft, and we walked into his apartment, and there was the server running on the floor, and this crazy, weird-looking Verizon giant phone, and he said, "Don't call me. There's an email that's about to go from there to my phone." And all of us guys were kind of like, "Come on, let's go get wings. Don't worry about that." And we stood there, and he got an email on his phone, and that was the very first time ActiveSync ever worked. And it was very amazing, and it was kind of blew my mind at the time. And I thought, oh, okay, whatever. We're doing stuff with phones now. I'll have to get a new data plan. But, I mean, it really was very early. I mean, this was 2000, 2001. And from how far that's come to really the protocol that the world uses for connectivity to Exchange. And it all started just really back in the Exchange team, really trying to push the limits of how to manage and how to access email. And then all the way to unified messaging and delivering voice into your mailbox. I mean, these were the big pillar items that we really thought about as Exchange moved forward, all the while with bringing in mission-critical availability, bringing in anti-spam protection. I used to work on the team called Exchange Hosted Services, which brought on board a company called FrontBridge, which really became the start and the next generation of our spam filtering, which has now all moved into the Exchange environment. And then the cloud on your terms, and you see that in November 2008, because that's the day we launched BPOS. And that became a huge step forward from an Exchange perspective of utilizing Exchange as a multi-tenant environment. And at the time, it was Exchange 2007. And we learned a lot about how Exchange ran in a multi-tenant environment, which really brought us to the cloud on your terms, which is really from that point forward, the Exchange teams, Link teams, SharePoint teams, all becoming services first. And you saw that with the first releases of Exchange 2010. It was the first time that these exchange infrastructure and technologies was cloud aware. And it really became a place where you could talk about hybrid. We could talk about free busy across the cloud. We could talk about having mailboxes on premises, having deep integrations with whatever line of business you have on-prem, and also having mailboxes in the cloud with split environments. And that really started with that 2010. And as we move forward to 2013, we saw just a ton of features coming into the on-premises Exchange that we had learned from running millions and millions of mailboxes in the cloud. So whenever customers ask me, hey, are you still developing for on-prem, or what is in a service pack, or what's important, and how does it flow back to the on-premises model? You know, when I look at Exchange 2013 on-premises, it really is amazing how many features that kept people up at night, kept the service running, kept things highly available, rolled right back down into the normal on-premises server products. So it still is innovate, lead with the cloud, and then always bring that back to our on-premises environments. So that's kind of the messaging side of Exchange and talking about Exchange Online, which really has grown from humble roots to being the core online infrastructure for so many millions of customers. And what it looks like to an end user is massively, hugely important, because they don't look at Exchange. They don't look at their Exchange mailbox. An end user doesn't experience a server. The end user experiences a device. They experience Outlook. They experience things from their desktop. You know, and when our customers say, well, Outlook's down. Well, okay, perfect, Outlook's down, but there's an Exchange server behind it. But that's such a ingrained end user thing that Outlook is mail. And so Outlook is a huge part of the experience. And so with Office 365, the real latest launch last February, and then now as we're into this kind of month-to-month services cycle, you have seen a ton of work and effort go into the client-side experience with Outlook. And so just to name a few, is anyone using 2013 client Outlook? Good. So a lot of this, hopefully I'll kind of fly through for some review, but maybe you'll pick up a few features from an end user perspective. It really is a new look, and it's been designed to be that flat kind of new Office look and feel. As we go across devices, things need to be flat if you're doing touch. 1,000 windows open or things you have to do between windows becomes difficult with if you're using touch. But we also kept in play mouse, pointer. You don't have to be in touch mode. It's actually, desktop is desktop. You can go into touch mode if you need to. But you see a lot of the features and integration points with the presence information, and that's where Link comes into play immediately into Outlook. You know, the Outlook is Outlook, but as soon as you add Link and presence information, it really lights up that experience. If you can see where people are, if you can see who they are as far as their directory and where they sit and how they communicate, and you see a lot of the investments going from an Outlook perspective into more of that social aspect of knowing where people are. You saw a huge play on that with the unified groups, the new groups in the keynote. I mean, those are Outlook experiences with Yammer backends, with Yammer communications and messages, all being fed into that Outlook experience. Inline reply is another piece, so not having to bounce around through windows, keeping that flat look and feel to make it easier for the end user to continue with touch or just getting their work done really quickly. Staying connected and protected on the go, and I'll do a little demonstration of this too from a couple different devices, but it's about bringing that experience, no matter where you are, on a phone, through the Outlook web apps, across the different app stores, but bringing those experiences into the new age of touch and the new age of devices. And you see a big investment from the Exchange team within these experiences. And that, to me, at Microsoft is a little bit different because Outlook's Outlook, Office Client. The Office Client team owns that and develops that. And Exchange does the Outlook web apps. It does the experiences because these are being presented from Exchange. This is just a window on whatever device you're on going into Exchange. So it's a really core experience to the Exchange model. And as you see here, no matter if you're on wide, if you're on narrow, trying to give you really great experiences, no matter what devices you're using. Sometimes we joke a little bit about ActiveSync that it's become the new domain join because you can do so many things with ActiveSync now. But across apps, you have this web app model across all these devices. And what it does is it doesn't store data on the device. You can wipe it. You can control it. You can put pins on it so that when your end users are carrying around their favorite device, it's not downloading all of the email to that device. What's a way to control that without using native applications in ActiveSync? Being able to do it through the Office web apps or the Outlook web apps. So having that window into Exchange in a very native look and feel, but it still is Outlook web apps, and it is connecting to that Exchange server. So it gives you a lot of different capabilities from the IT side to be able to control the mail flow on those devices. As far as finding people easily, that's a huge part of what Exchange delivers and how you need to be able to search for, find people who are online, find your contacts. I mean, this is just inherent to that Exchange and communications piece. If you can't find the right person, then you can't send the email, you can't get in communication with them. So very simple here, seeing, you know, search and capabilities directly through, sorry, I skipped too many on that, directly through your people, your calendar, your contacts, your business contacts through the global address list. You know, and that's with Exchange Online, and you're doing directory synchronization, you're pushing everything from your Active Directory into the cloud. The look and feel from an end user perspective is your Active Directory. It's your gal, it's your people, it's your security groups, it's your DLs. From an end user perspective, there is no way they should ever know that it's Exchange Online. So then moving forward with a little bit of the user experience about apps. And I know at SharePoint there are a ton of sessions about apps, but there are Exchange apps built on the same model, built from the same Office store, and then controlled by IT. Even if you're a cloud user, you control this from an IT perspective, but it's basically bringing context into mail, and it's doing it across Outlook. It's doing it across Outlook web access. If you're on the web through a browser, it doesn't matter. You deploy once to the Exchange side, and then it's available to every user no matter what device they're on. So you could do line of business apps. You see a very easy example of LinkedIn here that's basically parsing the email, presenting the user with an app, helping them get on with their day, be more productive. And always the question from an IT crew is, how do I turn that off? So you can always turn it off. You can always control exactly what apps get shown, but you can always turn them off. You can always enable them. You know, this is something as we at Microsoft constantly dog food, our MSIT is always throwing these at us. And every time I log into Outlook, I've got a different little app that I can start doing. And from my perspective, I don't use all of them, but sometimes MSIT throws one at us, and I think that's the one. Maybe it looks up a customer. Maybe it looks up something inside our own network. And they do a really good job of kind of pushing those out and getting feedback on those. And that's a big critical part of the communication path. When you're allowing these to happen, They just show up for the user. They don't have to install anything. It just happens. If there's context, it does it. I talked about offline, which you can always not allow, but Office web apps, even through the browser, allowing offline access. So whether you're on a device or even if you're working from a browser, being able to have an experience offline, which I know in this today's day and age, we used to always say when we do demos, well, if you were in an airplane and you wouldn't be able to get online, but that's pretty much broken now because every airplane I go on, except when I fly overseas, I have online access. But if you need offline access, it's available from Exchange through the browser, which is a core piece of really being able to give a great experience even through the browser. So we're going to shift a little bit, and I've talked a little bit about Link, how it fits in, but I'm going to talk specifically about it, and then we'll roll into a demo and show how all of this kind of works together. But Link is a huge part of that communications and messaging. We see this as a real-time being able to communicate with people within your org, outside your org, connected through Skype. You know, it opens up a lot of new capabilities to be able to reach your, not just your end users, but your actual customers through Skype. If your customer, you know, millions and hundreds of millions of people using Skype, it's probably a fact that your customer has it. And being able to plan and engage with customers directly from Link all the way out to Skype, it's a big part of the federation and the features with the Skype side. But it's also multi-party HD video. It's room systems. It's being able to communicate very quickly. It's social and integrated design. And before social was social, Link was social. We've been talking about this for a lot of years from a social perspective, that what's more social than being able to communicate real time with people, see their face, see their video, and really be connected no matter where you are in the world. And that's something that we've always pushed forward from a Link perspective. So what does it look like with multi-party HD video? It's kind of that Brady Bunch look and feel. You see everybody's face. If they've got video, it plays video. It makes it really easy to have a bigger conversation, have your meetings, be able to see the people you're working with. Believe me, I'm one of the people who has a webcam on my desk that gets turned on maybe 5% of the time ever. But when I do, it's actually pretty powerful. And when I'm talking to customers or doing webcasts, always trying to do it with live video, because it just puts a whole different perspective on your conversation. And with Link and being able to do that with HD video and having that gallery, it makes those actual meetings happen, help you get more productive, and you can see everybody within your organization or out. And when you're a presenter, we've added a ton of new features to this. Did anyone ever use live meeting? I came from the live meeting team a little while ago too. So I think of Link as a huge step forward from live meeting when it comes to small group meetings, when it comes to true interaction, real time. But one of the things that I always missed was that 2,000 person meeting or that 1,000 person meeting with Q&A. Being able to lock everything down and you're basically just presenting. We've added a ton of those features into Link over the last 18 months, 2 years. And you see the Q&A manager coming. You see what it's trying to show you here is all the different ways that you can present and control so that it's not just about those 5 people or 10 people, but you can have a much bigger meeting, be able to control and manage, record it, and really have a much better experience. So that was something that we had to really transition from a live meeting side into that new way of doing work with Link. And now we have just a ton of those, and it's been optimized in a ton of ways to be able to allow that. So bigger meetings and being able to control, because as a presenter, and I do webcast after webcast, you want to be able to control, you want to be able to push those Q&A, you want to be able to show people polls and have that all saved as part of that meeting. Speaker view is another piece in Link, being able to see who's speaking, being able to see who's up, maybe not speaking, but you have the entire section of everybody who's on the meeting, and then you have who's speaking. So when you're leading with a group of people, it's really easy to be able to tell who's leading, who's talking, who's delivering the message that you're hearing. And it's about devices and choice. It wouldn't be Microsoft if we didn't have 50 ways of skewing something and purchasing something. But Link 2013, basic, Windows Store app, Link Web app, Link Mobile on the Mac, and then Link Room System, which I'll show you. The entire drive and intention is that we will be on every device, and we will give great experiences across those devices. So whether you're on a Windows phone, whether you're on iOS, whether you're on Android, being able to really work through those kind of scenarios. Anyone here ever used Link on a device? See, good, very good. And hopefully that's a great experience. I know we do it all the time from my Windows phone, and you know, and it is really truly that next step from a device's perspective. Personally, I always think, okay, the Link and the OneNote team are always the forerunners on devices. They always come out with that next piece that really pushes it across all the platforms. And I love seeing them kind of lead the way from that platform perspective. And here it is, just to talk about it for another few minutes. Same experience, so even if you're on your desktop, even if you're on your device, trying to give that same look and feel so you don't have to relearn what's going on and across all those devices. And I have a couple today to just walk into a few of them. And the browser, that's another critical piece. I talked about some of the bigger meetings or inviting people outside your organization. Maybe they don't have Link. Maybe they don't have rich clients. So it's the ability to give people access through a browser with a really great, rich experience. So being able to handle that meeting in a very rich fidelity, no matter what browser they're coming through. And that's huge for when you're working with customers. Maybe you're selling into another organization. Maybe you're marketing into there. If you have connectivity issues to a webcast or link issues to a webcast, it's never a great experience. So being able to bring that browser-based experience, have a really great experience, very easy, it helps those sales meetings, it helps those marketing meetings, it helps those communications with your customers to go really smoothly. And then the Link Room system, and it's obviously supported by partners. You see I don't have one here today, but it kind of looked like one for a second. Being able to have the Link Room system and have that full fidelity, double screen, present mode, being able to see people who are part of it, really bringing that experience to small offices, to big offices who want to be able to run these across the board, but giving you a full interactive experience with a Link Room meeting, not having to do kind of other providers or big IP or voice communication systems to deliver it, but all within the Link Room meeting. So developed as Microsoft as a Link endpoint, delivered by partners, packaged as a solution. The key here is it's very simple to deploy. It's easy to set up, join, and manage. If it's not easy to set up, join, or manage, and if it's not simple to deploy, it doesn't happen. So, you know, we've been through so many iterations just in Microsoft alone of different ways of communicating. And if it's hard to do, it doesn't get used. So it's really about bringing the simplicity out to your users. Oh, someone was taking a picture. I'll go back to that. Let you take another picture. All right, good. And I already uploaded these decks, so they should show up too. So I kind of hit the meeting room. No matter where you are, no matter how you're engaging from a Link perspective, you're going to be able to be in that same meeting. You're going to be able to see the same people and do the same activities. And from a contact and social apps, you know, I talked about these contact cards. Whether you're on OWA, whether you're on Outlook, whether you're using Link, whether you're seeing it through SharePoint, you know, you see a common bond across these people and organizational identity and shared contact cards. And that's a big piece of having that familiar experience, that no matter where you are in Office 365, no matter what you're using, you're having that same great experience of being able to communicate with people very quickly. And that's a OneNote one, but we'll keep going. I talk about Link a lot in the past, probably a little more than I do now, but the number one question I always get is, can I get a phone number to Link Online? Can someone call me on Link Online? And the answer is no. Just simply, no. And you see that right there with the PBX. But we make it really, really beneficial and easy to do link with a hybrid, not a hybrid scenario, to do link on premises with PBX features that then integrates with Office 365 online. So when you think of E4, sorry to talk SKUs here, but when you think of what E4 is from an Office 365 perspective, what E4 is saying to you is you are licensed from an end user for everyone who has link in E4, and you do need to put in a server. Because that server has those link PBX capabilities. And I want to be really clear on that because it's been a couple years since the Skype purchase, it's been a couple years since Link Online, and I still, to this day, always get the question, how do I get a phone number to my Link Online account? And it just doesn't, that's not what we do for Link Online. Maybe in the future, we'll see, but Link Online is IM, presence, meetings, peer-to-peer, audio and video. It's connecting to that person, not to a phone, or not to being able to dial out. So I just wanted to be really clear on that and show, you know, if you're on premises, everything is functioning from all the way from that link server, PBX side, with integration points. But as you move further and further online, the PBX pieces need to stay on premises. And Link has an extremely strong business around voice. And those voice practices, a lot of times we see customers try Link Online, deploy Link Online to a subset of users without voice, and then move straight into that voice scenario because it really is a game changer. So you can always start with Link Online and keep moving forward and figure out your voice at the same time. And we see that a lot in our pilots. So that's the end user side, and I'm actually going to switch over and show a couple of pieces. Question? Hello. Correct. Not from Microsoft, though. But, yep, there's always an answer. Partners always have the answer. So thank you for pointing that out. So I'm just going to switch over to this one. So I'm on my Surface, and a lot of you said that you are currently using Office 2013 on the client. So I just wanted to go through a couple pieces that we were talking about, show it on a couple different devices, but really simple. I have a few of my main favorites, David, Alex. These are actually people who are out in the expo, probably messing around with our computers right now, but our whole team is online and working together, and I can really easily send an IM. And this is so basic, but it's something that a lot of organizations may have different products or different capabilities to do. I'll see if someone's actually sitting at that desk or standing there. But I can IM and have presence, escalate into a peer-to-peer call, have voice, have video, really quickly, directly from a single instance of this. Whether it's video and showing, of course I want to allow access, showing that video, showing my desktop sharing, all the features from a link perspective, being able to show PowerPoints, whiteboards, I can do that directly from the client at any time. But really the key to me is that we start to see that information flow through an email. A lot of times I will start looking at Alex, see some of the information coming from him. A lot of times I'll start an email, start something with someone and see them online and bounce into an IM because they simply don't want to email anymore. And that's really easy to do. And it flows along and you can see that information as you go through Outlook. And I'm actually going to close and open because I just noticed it wasn't showing through. So you have the client, you have Outlook, you have the ability to not only do that directly in your desktop, but I also have my link client within a touch interface. So from a Windows Store app perspective, I have all the same people, some live tiles that show me. And from a touch experience, I can go right into Alex Darrow. I can make that call, join video, start chatting, and have just a really great touch experience. No matter where I am, no matter what device I'm on. So Alex and I can now have a meeting. We can discuss together. We can use IM. We can use voice, whether I'm using that touch interface or directly from the client. And that's all part of Office 365. So when you're licensed for Office 365 and you're licensed for Office 365 Pro Plus, this is all part of it. The apps, the software, whether you're using desktop, whether you're using it on an iPad, whether you're using it on any device, it's all part of that access. And we talk a lot about that of you have five devices, five PCs. You could do it on Mac. You could do it on PC. You have the store apps. You have the cross-platform apps. So Office 365, from a client perspective, delivers that, no matter where you are, no matter what device you're on. So if I'm on Windows, I can have that desktop. I can work through my normal day-to-day. And then if I want to use it on a smaller tablet, on a smaller piece, we have the Windows Store app. And then we also, and I wanted to show really quick the side, and I'll start a meeting, actually. I wanted to show a few things from the iOS perspective. Here I'm in Outlook Web Access. I am able to see all my emails, all the people who are online, my entire folder structure, and you see there it's not only my inbox and favorites, but it's also my in-place archive, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. But this is the experience from a device. If I was using a smaller form factor, it simply goes narrow to be able to handle that really easily with the one hand. Anyone using the Office web apps today or our Outlook web app? All right, so very good. There's a few of us. And as far as the touch experience, it really is bringing that native experience in. So even from a calendar or messaging, I have really great fidelity. Go into my calendar, see everything that's going on. Maybe I want to see month view, want to see normal view. And it keeps everything in a very touch-friendly way. So I can edit the series and occurrence. I didn't have to bounce around through any kind of different areas. It literally is very touch. It's very much from the iOS perspective, and I can do everything I need from here. One of the things you also saw earlier in the keynote, hopefully, is apps for Outlook. So whether I'm in Outlook and wanting to run an app, or simply in an iOS or another device, I actually have applications that you can deploy to your users, where maybe this is an Outlook request or a template that pushes me through to a line of business app. Or maybe it's something that helps me with my calendar and shows someone a meeting room or somewhere that I need to schedule. So you can build applications directly through, load them from an Exchange perspective, and then push them out to your end users. And you'll see that even if I'm on the iOS device, or even if I'm in my normal mailbox on Windows, same applications, same availability. So from that side, really easy to find and search and grab to people, see the unread with a great touch experience. So I have everything read here. So no matter how you're connecting in, the other amazing thing is that I'm on dog food, which means I'm on the early release stuff. So I had to install the Office or the Outlook web app on my device, and it connects into my dog food tenant. And I'll tell you, it does not look like this. It looks a little different. It has people and unified groups and all these crazy things. But the beauty of this app is it's just a window into Exchange. So I signed out of that, signed out of my dog food account, signed in with my demo account, and I'm on production. I didn't have to uninstall an app. I didn't have to redeploy Office on this device. It simply is my window into Exchange, and it just is based on your login. It bases where you're communicating with. So I can easily go from dog food to other tenants to older to newer, and that application is simply there on iOS, allowing me to have that access. Not within this application. You can have the various calendars and such, but you can do send as other mailboxes, but having them open, I do not believe is possible. So I'm just going to step back to my Windows machine and talk a little bit about those apps again, where you see here I have my Northwind proposals. I have some of these emails that I need to go through. And with apps, they can show up, but it's all based on context and if it's part of what you need to be working through. And so here you see across that top bar underneath is action items. And that's an app that just showed up because of the content, and I'll circle it here, action items. It showed up because of the content in the message. And it said, we think we found an action item for you. I don't know if you like when the computer tells you to do something, but it found an action item. I can actually set that to follow up, and it will go into my actions, and I can mark it as complete. Very simple app, but also effective, and shows you the contextual nature of what it's trying to do. We also have a meeting update here. Let me click around into my inbox. You can see I got a lot of action items going on. Budget spend, project updates. So this one is a new, another one, and you see it changed those apps based on the context of the message. These are coming from the Exchange server, and you see one, Bing Maps. Why is there a Bing Maps? Because it saw an address. Suggested meetings, it's because someone's suggesting that we meet. So if I go to my suggested meetings, it will always show me why it's suggesting the meeting. We think we found a meeting. Do you want to have this meeting? Very simple but effective ways of Outlook, no matter what device you're on, being able to help you schedule your meeting and get started. So I immediately could send this. I could insert a link meeting, and we could be on our way. From a Bing Maps perspective, right here within Outlook, whatever device I want to be on, phones, it's found that same location. It's showing me exactly where it is. And I can see that that's where my meeting is going to be. So Exchange delivering through that Outlook experience, making it much easier for the end users to have a great experience. One of the things as we got into Exchange security and protection that I also wanted to show is, and we had a session yesterday with for IT pros and Office 365, and probably 6 or 7 people at the end came up and said, how do you stop someone from emailing a credit card number? How do you stop someone from emailing information? And this isn't really a cloud thing. This is just people. Like, people email stuff they shouldn't. And whether you're in Office 365 or not, you need to be able to handle that. And one of the things I wanted to show really quickly and highlight is maybe I have Project Falcon, which is someone's asking me who's in charge and if I can follow up with information. And maybe I just thought I was actually doing my job, following up with someone with the customer outside my organization, outside the company. Outlook just told me this person's outside the company. Great, thanks for the information. That might help me or it might not. I might not even care. Here's the customer info. And I'm going to pop this message out, hit the insert, find some customer information that could get me fired, but I don't really know that. Maybe my policies don't share with me what I can and cannot send. But as I put that in there, Exchange says, whoa, 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 we have a DLP policy. We have DLP. It's in place. Do not send this. And so as an end user, I don't have to know the policy. I don't have to conform to the policy. Exchange is forcing the policy upon me. And what it saw was, inside the Northwind customer data is customer data. We don't want that data going outside the org. We set that policy in DLP, and it automatically stops the person from doing it. They can remove the person who was outside the org and not send it to them. They can see the policy tip. Oh, credit card numbers even. So maybe we allow some customer data, but we don't allow credit cards. It read the file, saw there was a credit card. You can use regex. You can use those policies that we'll get into in a minute. And it stops that. And the person can report it and maybe say, hey, I'll report this so that it gets logged, but I can't do anything with it. I'm stuck. So it's a very simple thing, but from a user experience, it's really great to stop them from hurting themselves when they don't know they're going to hurt everybody. So it's just something I want to show quickly to put into context as we go into the next piece here of discussion, which is security, compliance, policy management. So hopefully you guys feel good about the investments and the way we're helping end users message and communicate with each other. And then this gets into the point of the conversation where we say, how do we turn all this off? How do we lock it down? How do we enforce the policies from an organizational standpoint? And it comes in the way of a bunch of product names, but they're all part of Exchange Online. They're all built into Exchange Online. You see Exchange Online protection here, comprehensive protection. So this is where the cloud becomes the gateway. And you can do this with your on-premises Exchange also. You can use the cloud as your email gateway. But it is the antivirus, multi-engine, built on Forefront Online for Exchange, built on the last, 25 years of us having some of the highest traffic and highest susceptible services in the world. Think Hotmail, think some of those things. So it takes into account years and years of information from Microsoft handling spam in the best way possible and puts it into your experience. And this is part of every single mailbox on Exchange Online. This isn't extra, this isn't an add-on. This is us keeping you safe and secure in the best possible way, no matter if you have the cheapest possible mailbox within a cloud service. So it's built in. Enterprise class reliability, it's all geographically load balanced, queuing capabilities. So if you had an on-premises server using the cloud as your gateway, your servers go down, we actually will queue up in the cloud and wait till your server comes back online and then let mail flow back down. It's in no way DR, but it's a queuing capability, and it helps you not send out NDRs to your most trusted customers. And then a common administration console, from an Office 365 perspective, and hopefully you're seeing this if you've been part of this, and people who know about BPOS, you know where we came from, and you know where we are now, and it's all integrated administration. Working with SharePoint, Link, working with Exchange, working with DLP, all from a single space. And you saw that in Mikhail's keynote presentation, where even further we're going in the future to put everything into that single location to allow you to do discovery, admin, everything. It's really bringing everything into the Office 365 admin console. So I talked about spam, virus, enable more control, really trying to give our customers the basics. Here's your policies, here's your tips, here is your baseline, just hit go. If you need to do some kind of complex anti-spam, if you need to have X filters and everything else you do, great. But we want to set you up for success straight out of the box. So it's external threats quickly, enable more control from a block in bulk spam. And it just allows you to block email on language, block from where it's coming from. This is really basic stuff, but really it comes straight out of the box with Exchange Online. Anti-spam filtering. So content spam categories, whitelist, blacklist, connection filtering. Really giving you the control, like I mentioned, to lock it all down, to keep something open. Do you have partners who you work with that you want to have secure communication with? They have TLS. Then you force the TLS. You force the communication path with your partners, and then that message is encrypted all the way from Exchange Online to their Exchange server or wherever they sit with TLS. So it's about being able to have that control. Content filtering actions from a spam and quarantine X headers, really giving you the opportunity to send stuff if you want to the junk folder, or straight get rid of it. You don't want to have to use it. Simple configuration, block the attachments, send a notification so that you're not, we talked about it yesterday in an IT pro session, and it's a great quote that Alistair, my colleague, always uses. Don't treat Office 365 like a black box. You are IT, you are in control, you have all kinds of administrative settings and activities you can do to truly know what's going on within your service. So admin notifications and being able to go through. So to stop viruses and malware, it's all unified in the same management, spam, malware, and then policies. Use the transport rules and DLP, which I'll get into in a little bit that I showed, to give you really granular control. Need to have control over your documents. Do people send documents that you want to have RMS? Perfect. You can use DLP, transport rules, to notify those. You can use SharePoint to have RMS, to hold it by default, and anyone sending those links or files, it's going to have that granular control on RMS. Transport rules, and this gets into the admin side, really, you know, the core level of what you can do with Exchange Online and controlling your messaging. Conditions, actions, and exceptions. Very simple. You have a condition, so if this is happening, do this action, except if you're this person or this thing. So it really is a simple way of thinking about transport rules that is conditional. If this thing, if this recipient, if any attachment, if the sender, then do this action. Maybe send it through DLP. Maybe make sure it's IRM'd. Maybe make sure it goes somewhere else. Maybe you have an on-premises Zix, or I'm not going to say too many names out there, but a box that does all your encryption. Send it from the cloud to that box. Let it encrypt it. Send it back out. That's where transport rules really come into play. If it's from this business unit or this group, then make sure it's doing forced TLS. That's really where the transport rules come in. And, of course, you always want to have the exception that says, if not, then let's just let it send out. It's not that important to us. DLP policy templates, and this is what you just saw in my little demonstration. You can import DLP policy templates from security partners, but we've built them in based on common regulations. And you see that there with, you know, with a couple of those country names. You have Canada, you have a bunch of other countries. We've tried to do a great job of putting these templates in. You can use them by default, you can build your own, or you can just modify and continue from these templates. But this is the Australia Financial Data 15.030. This is the template that you would use for anything that happens, and it would automatically go through DLP, stop the message, encrypt the message, etc. So those templates really are open for you to do what you like. Really try to make it meet your regulatory requirements. You know, it's always the questions we get, and there's a trust and compliance session on Thursday with Vijay Kumar, or on Wednesday, actually, with Vijay. He'll go really into depth as far as the vision, what we're doing from a security and compliance, all of our certifications, but it always comes down to you as the customer and as IT to put the proper controls in place. Office 365 can do a ton of stuff for you. We can certify every level of the data center. We can make it no-touch admin, and we can make it ITAR, government cloud, all of these different things. But if you're allowing people to send things outside your organization they shouldn't through your own policy, there's nothing we can do about that except try to give you the tools to help it from not happening. So we try to build those tools, BAAs for HIPAA. It's my favorite question. Are you HIPAA compliant? Say, we give you all the tools to be HIPAA compliant. We give you the policy, we give you the help, but an organization needs to be HIPAA compliant. Sensitive content detection, predefined rules at sensitive content. You see here, it's just account numbers. You can use regex, and you can get really deep level if you need to. And extensibility for customer and ISV defined data types. So if you're sending through to someone else, if you're using an ISV, you can be integrated from that perspective. And the policy rules, they're built on the transport rules. Transport rules have that condition, then you have the policy in place, done. Mail transport rules say any kind of mail going through here, we are going to set a rule on top of it, even though if that rule is go out. But the DLP policy rules, that's how they're built, is on the transport. They take action to enforce, hold, block, audit to provide notification so that that's sensitive business data. PII, things that you set, credit cards, social security numbers built into those scenarios. Oh, and I had a nice build out for that. Exceptions, of course. Granular usage restrictions. You know, we're getting pretty deep level here as far as protecting your sensitive information, but RMS templates. So really forcing RMS through those rules. Do not forward, being able to control. You know, every now and then at Microsoft, some news comes out and it's in an email that I can only read and I can't do anything with. And we have those policies in place through RMS. And sometimes when I know it's a good one, it's RMS'd and IRM'd and I can barely get to it, and then I finally get to read some news that I heard about a week ago. But it is core to the experience of the user that you receive an email that says, don't print, don't forward, don't, can't do anything with it. You know it's part of that policy. And it makes it very easy, and I don't have to think about it as an end user. I simply know I can do nothing with that message. Microsoft's controlling that. You, from an IT perspective, can control that for your own end users. And we already showed this in my demo, but just to reiterate, credit cards, regex, dates, scans, emails, subject, body, and attachments when you're working through those policies. And what would it be if you couldn't report on it? How many of these hit policy? How many emails am I getting that are spammed? How many emails are being sent from someone that had an attachment that got stopped going through? That is where we really have to push from an IT side and help from Microsoft to allow you to see that information. Maybe you have to run a weekly report or monthly report for your own business needs. You can do that from the granular reporting options right from the admin center. So say, hey, this looks good. It's all going downwards. Perfect. Done. Monthly reports out the door. Download it to Excel workbook. We all love Excel. A lot of us run our businesses on Excel. You can throw all of these into Excel and be able to have a comprehensive view from a security perspective for your email and for DLP and for what's going on within the gateway, the true gateway from an email side. In Exchange Online reporting, this is a comprehensive view of mail flow. Drill into specific departures from policy, gain your business insights, be able to show all of that filtered outbound mail, inbound mail, and doing it in a way that's presentable. Put it into PowerPoint, utilize Excel. We don't have it locked into some system that you can only read from. So that is the end user stuff. How do you stop end users from being crazy end users? And then how do you report on that so that you know and can control, and it's not just a black box, it is tools and controls for you within Exchange, all the way to archiving. So when I think about end user stuff, security and compliance, and then you have archiving. And I think about it in that logical model because, all right, now I've blocked everything, but I have a giant mailbox, or I have compliance and issues and lawyers and things I need to do as an IT person to really deliver from a business perspective, not just the security and stopping people from doing things, but then that trail of archiving, that trail of what's actually going on inside my organization. And that really comes from many different forms of archiving. We're going to talk a little about the Exchange archiving. And it flows into the e-discovery side of Office 365, where link archiving, all of your link meetings, messages, all the things you do with link, Exchange, and then absolutely SharePoint. You see that we've built, you think about the Exchange team, when they're building archiving in Office 365, who do they go to? They go to the SharePoint team. Say, we need a place to show all this. So when you think about, and we get questions like, when do these features move to on-prem? Or when do these things in the cloud get decided if they land to on-premises? When you think about Office 365 from a dev perspective and from an operations, they can assume that these things are running together. And then they can build features across these teams within that Office 365 umbrella to say, we know you're going to have this version of Exchange. We know you're going to have this version of SharePoint and this version of Link. Let's all work together on an awesome new feature that we can deliver at Office 365 level. And you see a lot of that from the archiving e-discovery and pieces that are starting to really come together across the teams that are Office 365 related. And so if you do this on-prem, yes, you can try to do it on-prem, but you have to have all the right versions of every possible thing so that it looks to you like Office 365 and it looks to our devs like it's all together so that all those features can work. So preserving, archiving, it all comes across from preserving and then discover. If you can't discover the needle in the haystack, then why are you preserving the needle in the haystack? But we have to keep data, we have to ship data, we have to talk to lawyers about data, and I'm talking about like the IT end user perspective. So do you want to store everything? Do you want to preserve something? Do you want to have full data governance? You see on the slide, it's a bunch of details, but on-prem, online, EOA, Link Archives, Exchange, be able to search across everything from a storage management. Preservation is key when it comes to time-based in-place hold, query-based in-place hold. So you're saying, here's a query. Anything that fits this query, hold it. Maybe I want to hold it for a specific period of time. In-place holds across everything. So holding literally everything that's happening, and it's archiving within Office 365, it's unlimited. So it's unlimited. You have a 25 gig or 50 gig mailbox now, our archives go unlimited. So I believe we have default, you can go to 10 years, but it's not a limited amount of storage. So that's a scary thing to think about from an IT perspective. But from an end user perspective, it's a seamless experience. If you're in Outlook, if you're in OWA, you see the in-place archives. It looks kind of like a PST file, except it's in the cloud. It's there. It's stored. You don't ever have to worry about it. It's available to you, and it's unlimited. It's outside that 50 gig range. And you're going to handle that within Outlook. You're going to handle it within OWA. So for them, it's a seamless experience. It's simply archiving. They can see those folders. You set the policy. You push the policy down to them. And then they have it as part of their inbox no matter where they go, no matter what device. If they want to search, you can search that entire mailbox plus archive. So being able to, from an end user perspective, see everything that my IT organization has allowed me to see. All at once, integrated and combined. And improve workflow. So we talked about a lot about policies and delivering policies to the end users. And that really is the core piece of this, is that the end user doesn't have to build these out. You build them, give them an option, let them do that. If they want to keep something for a certain amount of time, that way they know and you know that they're keeping this for a certain amount of time. It's reported on. It's part of that. So you control the policies, and it has a really automated the deletion, automate the archival. Do you have to show these to your end users? No. You can do that on the back end. But giving people the responsibility also helps. Go ahead. It's late, second day.
Yeah, I'm sorry. When do you do e-discovery? Does that go to the archive as well?
Yes. The archive is the archive. And I think I'll show you that in a minute. Well, it's transparent to the end user. So the question was, when you do e-discovery, does it go to the archive? Yes, if that's you're archiving as part of e-discovery, it's going to search those archives. And I think I have a screenshot of that, actually. Managed storage, mailbox management, and I want to make sure we have enough time as we get to a couple of these last ones. So, delete policies, you manage the policy. You could say if something's going to delete, don't ever allow your users to go over a certain date. That's your policy. You set it. You handle it. Done. From an IT perspective, you can then tell your legal team or security or risk team, we have policies in place. Here are the policies. Done. We're done. And then you can have your nice arguments with them at the later time. But if you have a policy, that's a lot more than a lot of organizations have. So if you bring that policy, you show it as part of the technical nature of the product, and you say, we are delivering this to our end users. And just from a theoretical side of in-place e-discovery model, you have a huge volume and amount of data. But you don't need to find all that data. And it really becomes important that when you are looking for data, that the data you're finding isn't the volume, but it's the relevance. So as you move from holding something to searching for the needle in a haystack, we have to be able to deliver a tool to you that helps you take that volume of information and moves it down into what is relevant to what you're asking for. And that really is the model from an e-discovery perspective. Take everything you've got, make it relevant, make it searchable, put it all in one place. So when we look at the organization e-discovery, you retrieve content from Exchange, the archives, SharePoint, Link, file shares, being able to do this across a bunch of different products, give the compliance officer just their little e-discovery login, leave the end users alone. I like that line. So they have a place to go. They set up their discovery sets. They can search. They can export, giving them total control from the perspective of finding what they need to find and then handling it in the way that fits your policy. And when you think about it from a setting up those search locations, maybe the locations, people, teams, mailboxes that you're going through, the archives of those mailboxes, locations, and you see here an example of utilizing on-premises. Obviously, when you're Office 365, it doesn't quite look like that because it wouldn't know where that location is. But from an on-premises perspective, you can do that across a bunch of network shares. Select users, sites to preserve. Set mailboxes and DGs to preserve. So maybe it's a DG and not just a user, but a group. Identify and hold, and you can see that the hold status can be placed on mailboxes, SharePoint sites, any kind of those start dates. In place hold, you're literally setting it up to say everything that comes through here via this time, via this place, these things, you want to hold that forever until further notice. You can query what you want to. So if you want to set it up as a query, and this gets more towards the relevance, if it's not just volume, but it's relevant, maybe it has to have customer number. Anything with a customer number, I want to preserve. Anything with this customer number, Northwind Traders customer number, sent from these people, hold it. We have to have that as a hold. So it's up to you. You can build these out. You can get pretty complex with them, and that will turn on the hold for those scenarios. Help me. Regulatory requirements with a giant screenshot of the lock that everyone loves. For each case, allow the items to be placed one time in hold. Help with your compliance requirements. Help meet the regulatory requirements from in-place hold. Being able to hold all those settings. Specify number of days to hold them for a very long time there in the screenshot. But you'll also notice in the admin center, all one place for compliance and management. All of your protection, the information. And just before we kind of wind down here, big mailboxes are scary, lots of data is scary, but from the benefits of a large mailbox with archiving, it really should and help get rid of PSTs, get rid of having things float around on laptops, having people out in the field destroying their laptop and all their PSTs are gone, and you're left searching for a customer file from 2 years ago to help them close a deal. Or, I'm not going to say anything about the field. We're all good. But laptops float around, devices float around, PSTs float around, and trying to give our customers the ability to really eliminate that side of things. Simplify the email discovery and retention. It's about that volume. Yes, we have 50 gig mailboxes. What if everyone had 50 gig mailboxes? Well, if you can search for what you need and find it very quickly, what matters how big that mailbox is? It's less time spent managing that quota. I visit a lot of customers and still to this day, and I love having these conversations because we'll sometimes go in and at Microsoft or what we've been doing for so long, we have mailbox quotas that are huge and we never worry about it. And I'll go into organizations and they say, well, our people spend maybe an hour a day just managing their mail because their quota, because we can't build out more infrastructure. We can't do this or we can't do that. And then when we start having those conversations about hours and hours a day just to keep your mail out of your quota, that's when it becomes a very different productivity conversation. And that in the cloud, with that true kind of unlimited archive and huge mailboxes, from an end user perspective, you, from an IT side, you can deliver something brand new to them that takes that out of their day. And it's all access from all different clients. So hopefully from a messaging and communication side, you saw a lot of what's going on with Exchange, what's going on with Link, core services from an Office 365 perspective. Any questions whatsoever? Good stuff today? Good? The right level? All right. Thank you all very much. Any questions, come on up. I'll turn the mics off and we can discuss. So thank you all. Have a great evening. Hopefully you're going to the attendee party. It's going to be off the hook, so please go.